March 26th, 08. John Rivette interviewing R.F. Banks, number 3 or number?
Number 97.
We haven't been 97. Well, we talked 97 times, but I don't know.
Sounds about right.
About that. If I could, I think I didn't bring my notes to know exactly where we are, but before we go back to your life, which maybe was arrival here, I think it was, if I could ask you a couple other things.
Sure.
Which you can say, turn the tape recorder off, I don't want that on. Why the buffaloes in your office again? You've told me once, but I can't remember.
Oh, well, there are actually more of them, but the story is, it is all the fault of M. Richard Zinman, who said to me, when I was the dean of James Madison College sometime in the early 1970s, you know, this is sort of a crazy place over here. It's sort of like the Howdy Doody show, he said. And you know who presides over the Howdy Doody show? I said, yes, it's Buffalo Bob. So he started calling, other people started calling, and I got that is a replacement buffalo of the original, the big one.
Uh-huh.
And that was given to me by the staff over there. And so people would do what just John Rivette has done, which is to ask, why the buffalo? So I'd give them the story. And then 2 or 3 weeks later, another buffalo would arrive. So I have all sorts of buffaloes. I have many at home. I've got one from a speech that Jim Vertruba gave at the University of Buffalo. I have a little Billy buffalo, which is sort of like that one, but not quite, that Nancy Bogle brought back for me from Colorado. Mm-hmm. My wife even got these extraordinary little buffaloes on the desk that are made out of bits of clay and all assembled in pieces.
Right.
And so it's just one of these stupid things that sort of took off by just sort of word of mouth and then became a custom, a tradition, a practice, whatever you want to call it. So it's not a very... Not a very enervating or
I just couldn't remember.
Deep story, but that was it.
So would you remind me of when you were hired in here?
At the university?
At MSU, yeah.
Yeah, August 1967.
Okay. And that was to work in what unit?
Well, that was to work in the School of Labor and Industrial Relations, which was really the prime contact point. And, you know, this is the kind of classic story of the days before positions were posted, because MSU never posted openings until 1971. So how do you get it? You get it through contacts. And I had made friends while he was on sabbatical with Bob McCursey, whose name may mean something to you, who was then at Cornell.
Mm-hmm.
Come from Chicago, went to Cornell, was their director, then ended up at MIT. And he was an active fellow and gave papers and had a lot of connections. So he knew everyone. He said, you know, if you want to go back, said it's foolish to go back to the United States and just sort of rummage around, like go to the IRR meetings and lurk in the hallways. He said, you know, you may make a hit, but it's pretty unlikely. Let me give you what you're sort of interested in. And I'd been doing comparative labor relations and British labor relations stuff and labor relations stuff in general. And so I got, he identified MSU, the University of Buffalo, interestingly enough. Fellow by the name of Joe Schister. Does that name mean anything to you?
Basically, I don't know why.
The history of labor relations. They had a little program there. And the labor and industrial relations center at Rutgers, which was largely a labor education unit.
Uh-huh.
Herb Levine was the fellow who was there for many years. So I interviewed at all those places.
Oh.
When I came over a Christmas time, is curiously enough, my son had been born in the previous January, and we were looking forward to come back, combined with the job hunting with his grandfather, seeing his first grandson. He died 2 weeks before we came back, so I had to come back to his funeral, see him buried, then come back again and bring Claire and little boy with me back in just over the Christmas period. Mm. So I came here and had, again, in terms of modern day, and rather very untypical in more recent times, interview experience. I just chatted with people. I talked with Bill Fonts. I talked with Fred Haler. I talked with most of the labor program service guys, because I was sort of interested in the area, because as a sideline to make a bit of money, and then part of my work at the LSE had to do with various forms of labor education. I can't, who else I remember.
Well, Rufus would have been here.
Rufus, I talked to one, I sort of worked my way up and down the hall there. Talked with Einar Hardeen, I remember. I didn't talk with Al Blum, who was never there, which was usually the case.
Did they still have joint appointments so that were very earliest years? Adams had an econ and did some stuff in the LIR Center, and
I think they were
LaRouted
both. I think they were on the back end of all
that
stuff.
But yeah. That
does remind me that my interviews, particularly with the Labor Program Service guys, I remember, were in that little annex to Marshall Hall, because I had
their
offices over there.
Right.
Because maybe Kedzie Hall hadn't been built, or was being built at that time.
It's somewhere around 67.
Yeah, so that may be the case.
But I know, talking to several of them, that that's where they were.
So the story, so they, again, as usual, I don't really answer your questions directly. But my assignment was in the School of Labor and Industrial Relations, and Jack Stever said, we'd be delighted to have you, but we don't have funds for a full-time position. However, there is this fellow by the name of Herb Garfinkel that's sitting in a rented office, vacant office, which has been assigned to him over in Fee Hall, and he's building this program called James Madison College. And he sort of described in very loose terms what the role and function of that is.
Mm-hmm.
He said they're looking for faculty, and they might be interested in having you join them on a joint appointment basis. So I went and talked to Garfinkel. Do you know Herb Garfinkel?
I know the name, but I don't.
Well, he was a man who has said that if he went in with a pitch for a program, he would never take yes for an answer. The provost said, Herb, that's a great idea, let's do it. He said, but I got to tell you why. And he talked for 45 minutes, and people think, Herb, get the hell out of here. You know, he may change his mind.
He wrote a review of the Madison a couple of years after it had gotten started, and I've read that article.
So we had a long chat, and at the end of it, he said, oh, I think it would be great. Why don't you just, if the School of Labor formally offers you a job, we'll just join them and supplement it. So it was a 60-40 appointment. So 40% in the Madison and 60% in the school, which essentially was a kind of 50-50 during the year, and then it was an annual appointment, and I had work to do in the summer.
Was that fairly rare to have a joint appointment in those years?
I think it was rare outside of units linked with the Ag Experiment Station and the basic science departments in natural science with the medical schools, because that's, of course, the philosophy that MSU really established and pioneered.
Because it had been apparently in the 50s, like I say, when the LIR Center started, I believe everybody except for the labor extension was history and LIR Center.
Yeah, there were a number of things. I remember.
But that was partly because LIR Center wasn't a degree, wasn't teaching any degree classes.
And there was the notion that, quote, as John Dietrich told me, hissed at me, because I was sent over, elected by my LIR colleagues, to be the college rep. This is my first year on the University Committee on Curriculum. And I was sent over with their proposal to establish a master's program, to which Dietrich hissed.
The commitment was they would never have any right to teach any courses. It would all be extension and research.
I said, what do I know? I'm just an idiot. Jessica. So in any event, I think that's why that there were joint arrangements, because you couldn't hire people with tenure in the school at that point early on. So they had to have an affiliation with another union.
Yeah, so it was a different kind of
a labor program service. Now, I don't know the history, and you may know of this, because it goes on in a number of places, whether the labor program or the extension people should have tenure system faculty appointments. In some places, they don't. Mm-hmm. MSU, they always have had them.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe, and correct me, the Halers, the Russ Allens, the Reapers, they had appointments in economics, I think, along with the labor school. That may be a misremembrance.
I interviewed Bob a long time ago. I thought that he did not, but I could be wrong about that. But
they may have had appointments there. You know, it was only in 1979, and then it was promulgated in 1980 that there was this policy enunciated by Lee Winder, which is called faculty appointments in academic units, which meant that you either had to be a department school, non-departmentally organized residential college, to be able to have a tenure system appointment, which meant you couldn't have a tenure system appointment in the dean's office.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was largely a reaction to three sorts of things. I don't want to go down road too far on this because it's not really related to the experience. Partly because in many instances, and it was the College of Education that was affected, they would say suffered, people would get an appointment as something in the central administration, and there would just be a negotiated tenured appointment for them in education. Education had no say over it.
Uh-huh.
They didn't judge the person's qualifications, and it was always left ambiguous what happened if Jones departs as assistant vice president.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who most clearly comes to mind, it was a source of major controversy, was Mary Lee Davis,
mm-hmm.
because she worked for Jack Breslin and so on.
Mm-hmm.
That was one piece. The other piece, which was heightened by Cecil Mackey's arrival in 1979, was that we had all these coaches, a good fraction of which had not been good coaches and had been relieved of duties and were essentially in a range of units, but particularly kinesiology or whatever it was called, health and physical education at that point. And they weren't doing very much. They were teaching skills courses and so on.
Mm-hmm.
He said, this is ridiculous. They should be on contracts. They shouldn't be tenure. Said, no, Mr. Hanna, of course, would argue, you know, coaches are teachers and they should be faculty and so on. So that was one piece. Then the third piece was to try to look more broadly, and again, Cecil and Lee pushed at this. You know, these are significant commitments to make to people, and there's a kind of academic history and rationale why tenure is important. And a lot of people in student affairs, and I think particularly at the counseling center, had faculty appointments. You had people in the Office of Institutional Research, which is Bilek's unit now, that had faculty appointments. And the view was, I mean, this doesn't make sense. You
uh-huh.
don't really administer the type.
Mm-hmm.
So it is quite possible that the Rebuses, Halers, et cetera, of the world who were prior to that period of time could have had tenure system or tenured faculty appointments in the school.
I'd have to look back at some records. In the very early years of the center was in three colleges, or reported to three deans. One was social science, one was lifelong ed, and I'm not sure what the other was.
Business?
Maybe. And it's only sort of in the earlier 60s when they then become an academic program and a more traditional academic program and become a school instead of a center.
Right.
That they then are reporting just the College of Social Science dean.
Yeah.
But I'm confused that you just said you were involved in the master's program. I thought that preceded your arrival.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I have a very strong impression that while there was work that had been done before I arrived, because again, you started from ground zero, you had to develop the program, and you know, a set of folks looked at what other schools were doing and what they wanted to do and so on. I remember very well going with a great stack of sheets and
mm-hmm.
having to explain why this was all a great idea.
To create master's program.
Yeah, great. Particularly in the presence of a fellow by the name of Win Oberg, I don't know what that name
mm-hmm.
is, an old management professor who thought this was the worst, most god-awful thing ever to happen, because within the framework of their management department, they had labor relations and human resources and
mm-hmm.
so on, and they argued that this was just a fundamental duplication.
And how was it that their argument didn't go farther and block the schools having a master's program? Was
well, you know, like politics as in life, he didn't have the votes. And
okay.
then the related question is, why didn't he have the votes? I think that people in the school did a very good job of articulating the distinction and the kind of quasi-unique thrust that they would make in the program. I think that the faculty at that point that was there were well recognized both in the university and the profession.
Mm-hmm.
And I think people thought this was value added. I think the labor stuff in the management department, the business school, was sort of an add-on. I mean, they really didn't have much
mm-hmm.
in the way of substance. And I guess one can say somewhat shyly, maybe at my effectiveness of articulating all these
mm-hmm.
arguments had some
mm-hmm.
sway.
So you had to push through in whatever this is, 68, 69, the names of the new courses and their
yeah,
content.
And their mm-hmm. content and the requirements for the degree and
mm-hmm.
so on. There was no, as I recall, and again, fading memories, as I recall, there was no debate in the academic council. In those days, which has been
mm-hmm.
true except for the last very short period of time, you would get the great report,
mm-hmm.
you see. So you had to have really a bugbear, something under your skin, to sort of read all that stuff and stand up and complain.
Mm-hmm. But you recall no debate in academic
council
about
but
the
I,
master's and
but
labor.
I remember fairly substantial debate in the university committee and curriculum. There is a kind of side wrinkle
mm-hmm.
that worked to the advantage. In those days, well, let me back up.
Mm-hmm.
I had the pleasure or opportunity, however you want to describe it,
mm-hmm.
of being the first faculty member of that committee selected to serve as its chair, because prior to 1969, the president / provost picked the chair. And that was John Dietrich, who was an assistant provost. And John Hanna would say in a variety of circles that, depending on whether he was happy or unhappy with the faculty, he would say that, you know, the faculty weren't good enough to sort of advance their academic programs. They would replicate themselves, and therefore one needed someone to provide watch and guidance and so on.
So you're the first faculty member elected as chair of
the University Committee and Curriculum,
mm-hmm.
which was, in the 1969-70 academic year, when in fact I'd gone to James Madison, but I'd been on the committee before. But to go back to the point I was making, one of the suggestions I made, which has been adopted now and has been operative ever since, is to divide the committee into four subgroups, A, B, and C, which deal with groupings of various colleges, so you would have some focused expertise.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't mean you couldn't ask a question when the report
mm-hmm.
came up,
mm-hmm.
but again, as a committee member, if you can
mm-hmm.
imagine, you would get these agendas, which were huge
mm-hmm.
and great. So I remember old Oberg would sort of come in, and he would have a stack that would go all the way down, and you'd leave them on the table.
Of course.
And then someone would say, now we're on that, which course was it? And then he'd sort of go through his pile. And then there's subcommittee D, which really dealt with issues of policy and
mm-hmm.
practice, and those have continued. I think that the LIR program was advantaged by having it discussed in the full committee, because I think a good fraction of people had never read the stuff. And, you know, at some kind of fairly general level said, yeah, that seems reasonable to us.
Uh-huh.
So, you know.
There was a growth period for the university,
yeah.
So you were adding a lot of classes.
Yeah, sure, and this was,
programs.
And we don't have a dog in this fight. I mean, the folks from Arts and Letters, from history, they didn't care one way or the other
mm-hmm.
if this program was. I mean,
only business would have thought that
only
was duplicative.
Only business is the one that's duplicative.
Yeah.
Psychology might have, but they had IO at that point, and that was a fairly narrow area that they've carved out. So.
And this was a pretty multidisciplinary school that's
yeah.
being, within degree that's being created.
Yeah, and the faculty came from different backgrounds.
Right.
And supplemented by the folks you were talking about earlier, who were predominantly and originally appointed in another unit and then signed on for research purposes.
Mm-hmm.
I was, LaRue had gone by the time I was there, but I know he wrote stuff. I've
mm-hmm.
read some of the stuff he's written that was
mm-hmm.
supported. Bill Fonts was from sociology, but was in the school.
Mm-hmm.
Jim Soltaw, whose name you may remember, was
mm-hmm.
a historian and was there. Herb Garfinkel actually had an appointment for a time
mm-hmm.
On a research basis. Between political science and the school. There may be others.
Well, I interviewed Walter, and he said he was.
Yeah, well, it doesn't come as a surprise, but Walter had long gone.
Oh, absolutely.
In
this was just at some point in the beginning
of
their careers.
I don't recall it, but I do recall all the others I wrote,
mm-hmm.
partly because of the off-print series.
Exactly,
these
right.
These are all research arrangements.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no. So you started the appointment 60-40, So you were teaching in both programs? For LAR, you were teaching comparative?
Yeah.
For Madison, you were teaching?
I was teaching, because the program was developing, I essentially was, a lot of the time was on planning programs. But I did teach in a sense, not in a sense, I did teach in their introductory course. I mean, that was the only thing that was on the books.
The first year.
The very first year.
Mm-hmm.
And then in the second year, there was a course in the manpower area that we taught. That was an interesting experience because there were all sorts of rumbles and complaints, particularly from economics, that were worried about duplication. People were a lot more sensitive in those days. I remember old John Henderson, I remember going over to the meeting with the economics department faculty, which was always an interesting experience. And so I said, well, you know, we looked at the catalog, and, oh, hell, he said the catalog doesn't mean a damn thing. They put any crap in there they want to, and then people do what they want to. It was this young assistant. I was sort of taken aback by that. Let me see.
What year are we talking?
Probably 19... Initially, it's really 67, 8, 68, 9. And I guess the other thing I would say, you asked me what I was doing at James Madison. We had... a very interesting experience, challenging experience, much unlike either Justin Morrill, which is established, or Lyman Briggs, or the new residential college. We planned in the springtime, late spring and summer, most of it was done in the summer, the content of the introductory course for beginning students,
mm-hmm.
which was a very elaborate program.
Mm-hmm.
It didn't have a text. It used books and articles and videos. It had a substantial syllabus, about a 30 or 40 page syllabus. It had annotations and questions. And
it's a group project.
A group project.
Mm.
And you can see over time how that got modified as faculty complained that you know, their own work suffered. And so they've gone back and forth on that. But it became clear, and this was Herb Garfinkel's read, that the history of the establishment of the college was somewhat murky and was really developed in the juxtaposition of a departing dean, who was a fellow by the name of Lou McQuitty from psychology, chair of psychology. The psychologists in the early years were always the deans because it was the biggest department, and they elected people by vote, so they always got more votes than anyone else. He got angry at the provost for some reason unconnected with James Madison. He left, went to Florida.
Uh-huh.
It was then an interim arrangement. Then Lee Winder was picked, and in that window, John Hanna thought it would be a great idea to have another one of these colleges in social science and another one in natural science to sort of match Justin Morrill, which still at that point was kind of international studies, foreign language in terms of their focus and so on. But it was clear, particularly in terms of the dynamics of the relationship between Garfinkel and Winder. Originally, Herb Garfinkel was associate dean of social science. And the proposal that Jake Neville, who was the provost, sent, and there's a letter somewhere, and I think they've lost all this stuff over James Madison, that went to Garfinkel, was on sabbatical in the Netherlands, saying, we'd like you to set up this feeder program for the College of Social Science. Herb, no shortage of chutzpah, this Herb Garfinkel. He wrote, he said, I'm delighted to get your letter offering me the option to develop a new residential college. And he just went on. Juxtaposed along with that, Hannah was on his way out and did leave. And Walter Adams became the acting president. And it was very clear that Jake Neville was not going to be acting president. And he was terribly aggrieved by that.
Hmm.
So he then looked for other opportunities. And in fact, ended up as the some senior administrative position at the University of Nebraska.
Hmm.
And as a result of all of that, the program got established. Essentially, it slipped through the cracks, so you could say. Now, you know, one could argue that it could have floated on its own merits and so on. But Garfinkel believed, rightly or wrongly, that if one didn't get a full-blown curriculum developed, the college was at risk,
uh-huh.
even if it developed a first-year program. So in the second year, we had the task of developing all the program content of what were called and still called fields of concentration,
uh-huh.
equivalent to majors, plus a range of opportunities for joint appointments for students in with other disciplinary departments. And for whatever reason, for my sins, I got involved in doing all of that. And mm-hmm. that essentially was a large chunk of my, quote, assignment in the second year, at the
uh-huh.
portion of the first year and in the second year, which then led Garfinkel to say, wouldn't you like to come here and be the associate dean, which happened in 1969.
Okay.
And under that arrangement, Garfinkel was pretty straight on this, because I wanted to maintain some affiliation with the labor school, and he was very tough and crisp. He said, you'd shift 100% here, and you'd have no involvement with the school. Now, subsequently, in subsequent years, I would teach from time to time.
Uh-huh.
In the early years, I didn't do that or not, which had the great occasion of being taken to lunch. This is, here in my third year, just on the lip of being promoted and tenured, taken to lunch by Charlie Killingsworth,
uh-huh.
which is extraordinary, telling me I was making this terrible decision that
uh-huh.
would destroy my career.
That you should stay in LIR.
I should stay in the LIR school. Mm. Jack had put him up to doing it. I don't think Charlie knew who I was.
Uh-huh.
He certainly wouldn't have known who I was if I called him Charlie, that's for sure.
Yeah. Right. So you just then taught occasionally in LIR.
Yeah, but there was a break of time, and it actually didn't occur until Garfinkel left the deanship, which was only in 1971. He was there a very short period mm-hmm. of time. And
occasionally, meaning like once every other year? About
yeah, no, I actually got on a schedule where I taught it pretty much every year.
Okay.
And then I dropped off, and then I went back again. It was kind of curious.
Because you were doing that in the late 70s, early 80s, I thought.
Yeah.
But I guess I was thinking it was about every, like, twice.
Yeah, it could be.
Out of 3 years. I mean, it was
yeah,
kind of.
You could be right.
I'm just trying to remember when I first knew
there was
you
enough. It was enough to have a kind of regular opportunity. The question is whether it was every single year.
Yeah.
I think you may be right that it wasn't.
And then I can't remember when you kind of passed that off to Oliver. Was that late 80s or?
Yeah, I think so. Well, then I came here,
the admin
in
building.
1979,
uh-huh.
and in the initial period, rightly or wrongly, I thought, well, you know, I better sort of learn the trade here.
Mm-hmm.
Following the Terry Curry dictum, it's easier to teach this stuff than do it, right? you need to stick to your last. And then after that, I was able to do some teaching from time to time. And there were a string of people that were recruited, some who came and left, but with Peter Berg, I don't know how long he's been here, probably 6 years or something like that, 6-7 years.
In that range.
That old range. They're clearly,
yeah.
you know, whatever the need and interest is, it was covered. There was a young woman from Korea for a short time
mm-hmm.
that did Asians,
yeah.
Asian labor
yeah.
relations stuff. So that was pretty well covered. I did in the early, I remember in terms of comments about students, and I had a view which proved quickly to be mistaken of graduate students, that if you offered a class at 8:00 in the morning, people would come on time, and they would really, because they were there to learn, and people would sort of wander in at 8:20 and 8:30.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know whether I don't think I mentioned you. I mentioned it to someone. I sort of, took it as a great, sort of affront.
Uh-huh.
Oh, they said they do that to all the early morning classes.
Right.
They're all, because a lot of the courses were offered, 4 to 7 or 6
yeah.
to 10 or whatever.
Not exactly.
Sort of
but my recollection was in the later 80s or could have been after 79 and into the 90s. That you taught very infrequently in LIR, but you were still teaching once a year, once every other year in Madison,
yeah.
the public sector claim?
Yeah, we did. And again, I'd have to really mm-hmm. ferret back on the particular dates of that. Actually, yeah, we did that a number of times. I did it with Sam Baker.
Right.
Sam enjoyed doing it, and there was a kind of first chunk of the class that sort of looked at issues in public sector labor relations, which were,
mm-hmm.
you know, lectures, Q&A, there were some folks that
mm-hmm.
came, you came and talked
mm-hmm.
about, you know, public sector labor, its growth,
yeah.
its origin, those sorts of things. So there was a mixture.
Mm-hmm.
And then...
And that was a senior seminar.
Senior
okay.
seminar.
Yeah.
And then the second half, because this was after the semester system, and a fair chunk of time was devoted, something like 5 or 6 weeks, we took the Clerical Technical Union contract, changed all the names, and said this is a contract reopener. And we had, in the first day of either class or of the
mm-hmm.
session when we got to the case study,
mm-hmm.
We had students write, and I think it was the first day of class, a one-page essay and no more, no research, on should public sector employees have the right to strike.
Oh.
And curiously, over the years, the class would split right down the middle.
Really?
So the folks that opposed the right to strike, we put on the union team.
Okay.
And those who were in favor of the strike, we put them on the management team.
Very good.
Because they were then had to confront
yeah.
A different set of issues.
Great.
And Sam and I would work with
mm-hmm.
them as consultants to the various teams
uh-huh.
and so on. And they would go through and they would try to negotiate an agreement. And in true labor relations, we would usually be there to 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning on the last day. And in some instances, we ended up with a failure to agree. They just couldn't get it.
Interesting.
Some student shouted at another one and threatened to hit him or something in the course of the day. We said, hey, folks, this is just an exercise. You know, how can they be so stupid, he said. We laid all this stuff out.
Do you want me to keep on Madison or LIR?
Whichever you want to do.
Well, is there either of those you want to tell me more things about Madison? Or can?
Well, in Madison, of course, really very quickly on in 70-71, there was a great push generated by external forces, Kent State, anti-Vietnam War, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Students were radically inclined, very active, and so on. They were the kind of progenitors of the Tent City. Do you remember Tent City?
Mm-hmm.
It was over across here,
yeah.
pointing the right over, just over the river by the, where Math, Wells Hall, you know, down there between
yeah.
Wells Hall and Erickson Hall.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was a group, in fact, if you're interested, there was one of the leaders of the group. His name was Moose Betzel.
Mm-hmm.
He was a reporter for the Detroit Free Press, and now I think he's down in Ann Arbor. And he just thought that the Madison program as an experimental college was a sham, a snare, and a delusion, because his view of an experimental college, you would come, and if you'd like to experiment on something, you would experiment. You got tired of that, you then did something else. And we had all these, you know, courses and syllabi.
Uh-huh.
We even had something, curiously, which I had experience as dean, called the annual writing requirement.
Mm.
You had to have a certification you'd written a major paper.
Uh-huh.
And the history of that was that part of the dimension of James Madison was to run counter the trends in the general university, which was the large classes, multiple choice,
right.
limitation, and so on. And people just didn't like the idea of having to do this, A, because it was a lot of bureaucratic fuss,
mm-hmm.
and B, because they were doing it already.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember at one point early on, I guess either as acting dean in the first year or so as dean, of putting 2/3 of the academic of the student body on probation
because mm-hmm.
they hadn't filed. I said, "There's something wrong with this."
Uh-huh.
So we, in essence, just got rid of it because
mm-hmm.
it was clear from looking at the facts and circumstances that people were doing this stuff anyway.
Okay.
So. Internally, apart from the concern about the program, this was the heyday of student rights, responsibilities, and involvement in academic governance within the university generally,
mm-hmm.
and within the college as a particular entity. And along with that, which is the, again, in mirror image of the John Hanna experience, he recruited a lot of faculty. They were very good faculty. They wanted to have their say and their involvement, and John Hanna, that wasn't his style. Well, Garfinkel was, in many respects, like Hanna. And the Young Turks
mm-hmm.
sort of took him on, and we ended up with a debate about governance. And the proposal that was made initially, that was never really finally adopted, is that students and faculty would be equal
mm.
in matters of governance. And Garfinkel resigned. He said, the hell with that. I'm going back to political science. So he was dean from 66 in the planning period until 71. So I, at that point, was the associate dean. John Cantlin, who was provost, asked me to serve as acting dean, and then there was a search. A couple people came down and said, have you thought about this opportunity? And I said, gee, I never have. You know, I'm 34 years old, and what the hell am I supposed to be doing as a dean? Well, they said, you're not a real dean. This is a fairly tin pot operation. So they persuaded me that it was there. So I said, well, you know, nothing ventured, nothing gained. I probably learned something. And so I threw my hat in the ring, and I don't know, there were two or three or four other candidates. I can't remember them now. And I ended up getting the nod for the deanship.
Hmm. What year did you become dean?
Well, 71 is acting, and 72 is regular. Now, there were two challenges there. One, which was interesting, we had had an arrangement with a number of units, particularly in the old University College units, and in particular the ATL department, to send staff to teach a variant of of introductory writing for Madison students. What had happened historically is that in ATL you had one course, everyone taught it. And of course, if you had an opportunity to have more flexibility and freedom, it was a great opportunity. ATL in the early 70s went to a track system. And so it became more and more difficult to recruit people to do that. The other problem, of course, as you can see from the structure, you had problems with continuity. People came and went. You also had, candidly, talking with the chair of the department, he would be on occasion, I can't remember his name, he was Henry Silverman's predecessor. Would send you not really his best faculty, so you'd end up with people. So we devised a writing program from scratch, recruited people for it, and really did it in a juxtaposition with the freshman social science course that looked at broad issues and policy implications and implications. And this course, which is called Identity and Community in America, looked at personal issues, how one related in terms of family life, community issues, and so on. So it was a nice kind of juxtaposition. And both courses really insisted that students write. So you had two benefits at the upper division level. Students had a lot of experience in writing, and you came with a common background. You didn't have to say. Now, you remember what was said in Federalist 10. Everyone read Federalist 10. You see. They read it in the social science course. So we sort of worked all that through. The other major challenge, which soon became apparent in the early to mid-70s, is the assumption was, and you know, driven by the initial year, we put out a scruffy piece of paper that sort of in a very vague way described this program. We got 230 students just to sign up. We subsequently learned that the experimental residential was the element that attracted students, and it really reflected the kind of cultures and traditions of the area. What happened subsequently is that enrollment didn't grow, and there was a high rate of turnover. So when I was there as dean, which is not true now, it hasn't been true for years, we would lose 30% of the freshman class. Because the focus of that initial program was to tell folks what it was like. And if you wanted to do something else, that was not dishonorable. What we were doing is to give you an education. So two things were done. One, we recruited a couple of consultants, one of whom turned out to be Mike Boris. Do you remember Mike Boris? Poor old Mike Boris? Brother, who was down at Ann Arbor doing higher education, and another fellow who was college. And they came. These were, you know, we had no money at all, but these were, you know, essentially advanced graduate students, and they were sort of keen to come and look at this program. And they did a kind of consultant's report and made a number of suggestions. One of the suggestions they made, which was obvious, which is the admission staff are committed, dedicated, quality people, but they are recruiting students for, you fill in the number of undergraduate majors in the university. The Madison, Lyman Briggs, Justin Morrill experience are a little penumbra of those kinds of activities. And while they're not slighting them, they just don't have enough background interest and commitment. Now, some of my colleagues, for example, Gordon Roman, whose name you may remember, mm-hmm. he had a different view. He said they were deadbeats and layabouts and anti-intellectuals, and you know, they should all be marched somewhere and have their heads removed and so on. And he would say this publicly. And of course, you know, the reaction to that is that they would trash Justin Morrill. So politically, one wasn't going to do that. The other issue is, which is much less true today, the notion that admissions activity would be decentralized was anathema to the central administration. And the guy who was there was an assistant provost for admissions and records, a much higher level position now than director of admission, who was a guy by the name of Ira Polley, whose name you may remember.
Oh, I knew
who
Ira.
Was in political science for a time. I knew him, but I know. Ira was not an unpleasant fellow. He just had these sort of views. Well,
his title?
He was assistant provost for admissions and records.
Mm-hmm.
And he ran
mm-hmm.
financial aid, and he ran the recruitment.
This is after his years in state government.
Yeah.
When he first came back to the university.
And actually, he was recruited here by Cliff Wharton as a result of his major task force on lifelong education.
Mm-hmm.
Because the buzzword at that point was to reach out to non-traditional students mm-hmm. and so on. I can't even remember all the ins and outs, but I talked with John Cantlin and I said, look, we're on a mode. We were at about, Madison was about 470 students at that point. So the thing had just gone and then just sort of.
And was it what number?
About 470 or 75 students, total student body. So we started with the 230, roughly, and it had grown.
Mm-hmm.
And then it capped off
mm-hmm.
and never really grew. I mean, the notion was we would have at least 800, and depending on the documents you look, it could be 1,000, and so on.
Mm-hmm. And you wanted 800 to 1,000.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I talked to John Cantlin about this, and he sort of nodded and said, yeah, and he didn't give me any authorization to do anything. I filled in a position request for someone to serve in essence, although I dressed it up with some bits and pieces,
mm-hmm.
as a student recruiter.
Mm-hmm.
Lo and behold, the thing comes back with Cantlin's, the famous pink form with Cantlin's signature on it. So off I went. It became clear, as the person was recruited, that Polly knew nothing of this. Cantlin had said nothing to him.
This was a student recruiter position within JMC.
Within James Madison.
Yep.
And I went off and spent 2 or 3 days in hotel rooms talking to a large number of people. And I ended up recruiting a guy by the name of Lou Hirsch, whose name may be he, in fact, in time, after getting situated here, was the kind of idea developer and initial administrator, the kind of what I call on-campus weekend, students mm-hmm. who mm-hmm. had showed an interest and they applied and that would come up and so on. Hirsch was an extraordinary guy. He was a ABD in English literature, a lot of energy, a lot of commitment. And so he went out recruiting students. And he was the kind of person, to give an example that I always remember, that he talked to a student on the road who was a chess enthusiast.
Uh-huh.
And this was the day before email.
Mm-hmm.
Hirsch would come back that evening and write him a letter about some chess moves.
Right.
And send it to him in the mail and said, good to talk with you. Oh, and the kid says, I've got this guy that is really, interested in the particularities of what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
So he was sort of like a Pied Piper.
Yeah.
Within 2.5 years, the numbers went to almost 900 students. Because what he was able to do is mm-hmm. to address the issue of numbers,
mm-hmm. yeah.
first rate. Also the element, I think, which occurred in the late 70s, the student mood changed.
Uh-huh.
And people were worried about professional development,
right.
job opportunities, and so on. Mm-hmm. And the base core characteristics of the Madison program,
mm-hmm.
You want to be able to speak, you want to write, you
right.
want to make an argument. It's not,
mm-hmm.
trade school kind of orientation, but what are the skills that are going to advance you in life? that that made some impact. And he was a good articulator of that. And again, we pushed on a variety of visitation schedules and arrangements. We usually recruited the parents. They would like to have come back.
I don't know.
Much more keener than the students. But we got a good fraction of the students.
Yeah.
And then we looked internally at a number of programs. Mm-hmm. We made some changes. We got rid of this annual writing requirement stuff.
Mm-hmm.
We used students to recruit on the ground. We made sure that there was a good Madison representation in the context of the whatever they're called now, the aides that live on the student floor,
yeah,
the
upperclassmen
and so on, whatever the names
yeah.
are. And these, all these things sort of worked together.
Yeah. Mentors, maybe,
mentors.
Instead of RAs.
And, yeah, and so those numbers came up.
Mm-hmm.
So at the point that, I left in 79, the college was quite well established in numbers terms. An interesting dimension, because one of the arguments that was raised was the question of the program being more expensive than others. When you got the numbers up,
mm-hmm.
actually the cost differential is not all that great because while the teaching loads weren't heavier on average than the rest of the university, the average class enrollments, particularly at the upper division, sort of balance things out. The philosophy of the program, which I think is still largely held today, is that the first year, which would be the writing course
right.
and the social, should be small classes,
mm-hmm.
which is counter to the practice in many departments. So if you go to
mm-hmm.
political science or psychology, you're in your 300-member
right.
lecture class for Psych 100
mm-hmm.
or Political Science 100. The view was this was really the kind of building block for students.
Mm-hmm.
That meant when you became a sophomore and a junior, you
mm-hmm.
might be in a class of 40 or 50 people.
Right.
But you had a base on which to draw in terms of PPE.
I don't know what our time is, but...
What's your time?
Well...
You're about run out of it. Right?
Yeah.
Okay.
But could we switch to just a couple things?
Sure.
And then we'll schedule another time?
Yeah, that's fine. That's about, you know, their whole... I don't know how much you're interested in any of this. But those would be the two major... challenges.
Okay.
And the enrollment thing was I think the most major challenge in terms of the Madison experience.
I could even tell. I mean, I don't know. Without the tape, we could talk about this multi briefly if you want. Other things that I wanted to do that doesn't have to be today.
You just raise whatever you want. Deal with anything to the extent I can. I mean, if I can't answer it, I'll say I can't answer it.
Things I just jotted down. I'd like to ask you a little bit about what you knew, even though you were on the outside, about the Justin Morrill story. And there were a couple times so far you've sort of
yeah.
mentioned some things that related. I was curious to talk to you a little bit about the three collective bargaining elections in faculty.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if we finished talking about the history of the grievance procedure, but maybe we have. And then about collective bargaining and organizing of others on campus. You weren't involved in the AFSCME in those units, but you might have some comments. And then the grad students you were involved with.
Yeah.
So we could do any of those you want to now, or we can do all those in another
those
time.
Those are all a life's work if you add all of them. So I would say that depending on how much time you have, do you have 10 minutes? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
Why don't you pick whichever one you think we can make some reasonable progress? Because, for
well,
example, on the grievance procedure, I can't remember now. You need to tell me how far we got.
Yeah.
I'm sure we haven't completed it all, but we've done some chunk of it. So.
Well, let me. I assume that Justin Morrill would be a very brief one because you weren't that involved with it. So
yeah.
Why don't we do that? Right
Justin
now?
Morrill, of course, was up and running when I arrived. It started in '65. I had very little interaction, as did people in general, with Justin Morrill. An interesting experience, unlike the new residential college. There was. To my knowledge, this may be my limitation, there was no consultation with Madison, and maybe not Briggs, but I can't be definitive about that, with the faculty and the dean of Justin Morrow about, well, what did you learn, which seems sort of a foolish and sort of curious arrangement. Now, Garfinkel did meet regularly because I carried on that tradition when I became dean, the three deans. So obviously, he had some input in this respect, but I don't know much in terms of that. I do know that there was a kind of view, and Garfinkel really pushed this in recruitment, because the initial notion in Madison was to have a lot of joint appointments, and those just didn't work out because of the yin and yang of the two kinds of perspectives. But Morrill, to a very large degree, drew on people who were already here on campus, and there was an impression, probably an incorrect one, but a general impression that the people that came to Justin Morrill, to use the term that I heard mentioned more than once, were people that couldn't make it in the disciplines. So there was concern about the quality of the faculty. I think that's probably, you know, unfair to a significant degree, because I knew some of the people there, and they were perfectly fine teacher scholars. The only other two things I would say is that, for whatever set of reasons, I don't know the dynamics, that Justin Morrill really changed its focus, changed its whole curriculum in the early 70s to really respond to, as I was saying earlier, this experimenting college kind of frame of reference. Very student-centered, very flexible, a lot of opportunities to explore different views, issues, and perspectives. There was a whole lot of debate and discussion about whether they would get rid of letter grades, and students would end up with a portfolio of essays from faculty that would describe their role and so on.
You know, at the time, the U of M RC didn't use letter grades. They used pass-fail and descriptive.
I didn't.
I think actually that might have come somewhat in relationship to other residential colleges.
That may be part of that general kind of movement and perspective. No, I think it was clearly consistent with that philosophy and style. What happened toward the late 70s, which worked to the benefit of Madison, worked to the detriment of Justin Morrill, in which you had students who were very bright and very creative, and there's a group of Justin Morrill graduates who come back and regroup from time to time, and they're an extraordinary set of people. They really are. I mean, these are really self-motivated individuals, but they were a tiny fraction of the group, and when you were confronted with, well, what is this all going to add up for my profession and my career, it was very hard to give a definitive answer, and so the numbers started to fade in terms of that. The last thing I would say is connected with that. Gordon Roman left the deanship, went back to English. He was left a very unhappy man, as I recall, because unlike his relations with admissions officer, he trashed his colleagues in the English department. They were, you know, stuffy and hidebound and so on. And so then he comes back to that milieu, and he was not really very well welcomed. And he ended up really over in lifelong education. Cliff Wharton was very taken with Gordon Roman, and he was his consultant for a while on various things, because, again, Cliff was interested in lifelong education. Then there were a series of people, and I can't remember all of them, Barbara Ward being the last one, who was over the director of the School of Music, who's now long retired. And then enrollment faded. Then there was a Ford Foundation program that essentially gave people credit for life experience, which they then supplemented with classwork. And the Justin Morrill was called Justin Morrill Intercollege Programs. And it really became the administering vessel for that. And then by the time the big budget bang of 80, 81, 82 came, when it was proposed to get rid of all the residential colleges, Justin Morrill was really pretty much a kind of shell of its former self. Sort of, you can think of it as an old rotting barn that was sort of pushed and it fell over. That's what I recall.
That's helpful.
In terms of Justin Morrill.
Thanks. I will schedule another meeting to talk about some of those
whatever else you
those
want
other to topics.
Yeah.
Thanks. Appreciate it.